Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Mason's here. Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it, too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is pretty clear. We're tackling the comprehensive respiratory assessment head on.
That's right.
We've gone through the clinical guides, really dug deep, and we're aiming to pull out not just, you know, the basic steps, but the clinical thinking behind it all. Tying anatomy to sounds, to what you actually see.
Exactly. This isn't just about memorizing for a test. We're building, well, basically a functional reference guide.
Right.
Linking structure, function, and what goes wrong, the pathology. The goal is to get past just reciting inspection, palpation, percussion, auscultation.
Yeah, the checklist.
And really understand why you hear what you hear or see what you see. What's the mechanism?
Makes sense. So by the end of this, you, the listener, won't just know what abnormal sounds like. You'll understand why that crackle or wheeze is happening.
And where it's happening.
Exactly. Turning that theory into something you can use right away at the bedside. Okay. So let's start with the foundation. The blueprint, if you will. The thoracic cage.
Yeah.
It's this protective structure, right? Base of the neck down to the diaphragm.
And the landmarks here are absolute key for assessment. Anteriorly, you've got the sternum, manubrium, body, xiphoid process.
Mm-hmm.
But the really crucial spot is that little ridge, the sternal angle, where the manubrium meets the body.
Why is that one so important?
Well, it's not just a surface bump. It tells you where the second ribs attach. But even more critical for us, it marks the exact level where the trachea splits the bifurcation.
Okay, so knowing that angle lines up with the tracheal split puts everything else in context.
Yeah.
You've got the 12 pairs of ribs connecting to the vertebrae in the back.
Right.
And those spaces between them, the intercostal spaces, that's where we do a lot of our hands-on work. Palpation, percussion.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we follow the air path inside from there, you have the trachea. It's flexible, sits right in front of the esophagus, starts at the cricoid cartilage.
And then it branches at that sternal angle you mentioned.
It does. And right there, we hit a major clinical pearl, the differences between the left and right bronchi.
Ah, yes. This is important, isn't it? Tell us why.
Because the anatomy basically sets up the right side for trouble. The right main bronchus is shorter, it's wider, and it goes down much more vertically than the left.
So it's like a straighter path.
Exactly. It's a straighter shot. So if someone aspirates something, could be food, fluid, vomit, it's far, far more likely to end up in the right lung.
Okay. So if you suspect aspiration pneumonia,
you zero in on that right side, especially the lower lobes, for your initial assessment, that's where it's most likely to be.
Makes sense. And these airways, they have built-in defenses, right?
They do. They're lined with mucous membranes and these tiny little hairs called cilia. It's often called the mucociliary escalator.
Right.
These cilia are constantly beating upwards, sweeping mucus, dust, any foreign stuff back up towards the mouth to be cleared. It's a critical cleaning system.
So things like smoking or heavy pollution exposure would damage that escalator function.
Precisely. Damages the cilia, slows down that clearance, and that's why smokers have a much higher risk of respiratory infections. Stuff just sits down there longer.
Okay.
And then the lungs themselves?
They're basically cone-shaped, elastic. The top, the apex, actually peaks out just a little bit above the clavicle.
Oh, really? Higher than you might think.
Yep. And the base rests down on the diaphragm. And remember the lobes. Three on the right, only two on the left.
To make room for the heart.
Exactly.
And these are all wrapped up in the pleural membranes.
Correct. It's a thin, double-layered system. You've got the parietal pleura lining the inside of the chest cavity, and the visceral pleura directly covering the lungs themselves. It creates this sealed potential space.
The pleural space.
Right. And it's not truly empty. It contains just a tiny bit of lubricating serous fluid.
And that fluid is the key.
It's the key to frictionless breathing. Allows those two layers to just glide smoothly past each other as the lungs expand and contract. So if that fluid's gone, or if there's air or extra fluid in that space,
then you get problems. Pain, difficulty breathing. We'll talk about the sound that makes later the friction rub. But ultimately, this whole setup cage, airways, lungs, pleuras, it all works together for those four main jobs. Mm-hmm. Get oxygen in, get CO2 out, move gases around, and exchange them at the alveolar level.
Okay, so that's the fixed anatomy. But assessment isn't one size fits all, is it? We need to consider the person, culture, biology, age.
Absolutely crucial. You see biological variations in things like baseline lung volumes across different populations.
Okay.
And more significantly, different rates of diseases like lung cancer, asthma, COPD among various ethnic groups. A lot of that's tied to complex factors, historical exposures, socioeconomic status, smoking rates.
And there's a really important visual assessment point here too, related to skin color. Cyanosis.
Yes. That bluish tinge from low oxygen. In people with darker skin, you might not see that obvious blue color all over.
So where do you look?
You have to specifically check areas where the underlying blood vessels are more visible. The oral mucous membranes inside the mouth, the conjunctiva of the eyes, sometimes the palms or the nail beds. That's where you'll pick up those subtle changes.
Good tip. And age, that's probably the biggest modifier, right? What changes as people get older?
Oh, definitely. Dyspnea, or shortness of breath, is a big one. An older adult might report feeling breathless doing things that were easy before.
Why is that?
It's often due to age-related changes in the lungs themselves. They lose some elasticity, the chest wall gets stiffer, so lung compliance decreases. It just takes more work to move air.
And that stiffness affects the skeleton, too. You mentioned kyphosis.
Yeah, that exaggerated outward curve of the upper spine. It's quite common. And structurally, it limits how much the chest wall can move.
Literally, less room to breathe.
Basically, yes. Yeah. It can reduce the total volume of air the lungs can hold, making breathing less efficient.
Does pain perception change, too?
It can. For example, the sharp chest pain you'd expect with pleuritis inflammation of the pleura might actually be dull or even absent in an older person.
So you could miss something significant.
You could. Also, their cough reflex often isn't as strong or effective. This makes it harder to clear secretions, putting them at higher risk for things like atelectasis, collapsed alveoli, or pneumonia.
And you mentioned chest expansion decreases with age.
Overall, yes, the amount of movement might be less, but, and this is critical, it must still be symmetric. Both sides should move equally.
So if you see one side moving less than the other,
that's always abnormal, regardless of age. It immediately points towards a potential unilateral problem, like a collapsed lung segment, or maybe fluid or air building up on that one side. Even if the total movement is small, asymmetry is a red flag.
Okay, let's shift gears now to the patient's story, the subjective data. Before we even touch the patient, this history really guides our physical exam, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This is where we figure out what to really zero in on.
So, common complaints. Mm-hmm. Let's start with shortness of breath or dyspnea. How do we characterize that?
You need details. Does it happen with activity or even at rest? That's a big difference. And crucially, do they need pillows to prop themselves up to sleep?
Orthopnea.
Yes, orthopnea. Having to sleep upright suggests fluid is backing up into the lungs when they lie flat. Classic sign you see with congestive heart failure or CHF.
And we need to ask about other related symptoms too, right? Connecting respiratory to other systems.
Definitely. Are their ankles swollen? That's edema, often linked to CHF. Do they get chest pain or pressure angina? And you have to ask about PND.
Paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea.
Right. Waking up suddenly at night, gasping for air. That's often a more severe sign of that fluid shifting back into the central circulation during sleep, really overwhelming the lungs. Can also be related to sleep apnea, too.
Okay. What about chest pain? How do we sort out if it's lungs or heart?
The description is key. Does the pain get worse with a deep breath or coughing? Is there a fever? Sharp, localized pain that increases with breathing points strongly towards pleuritis, that pleural inflammation.
Versus cardiac pain.
Cardiac pain is often described differently. More crushing, squeezing, maybe radiating to the jaw or arm, and usually not related to breathing or position. That's obviously much more urgent.
And cough, another really common one.
Yeah, and again, details matter. When does it happen? First thing in the morning often suggests chronic bronchitis, clearing out overnight secretions. Nighttime cough could be post-nasal drip or even GERD.
GERD, acid reflux.
Yep. Stomach acid refluxing up can irritate the airways and trigger a cough, especially when lying down. There is a known link between poorly controlled asthma and GERD.
Interesting connection. And productive versus non-productive cough.
Crucial distinction. If it's productive, meaning they're coughing up sputum, we need to know what it looks like. The color tells a story.
Okay, break down the colors for us.
Sure. White or clear sputum usually suggests a common cold, maybe a viral infection, or sometimes chronic bronchitis.
Yellow or green.
That's the classic sign of a bacterial infection brewing somewhere in the respiratory tract. Pus, basically.
Bloody sputum. Hemoptysis.
Always serious. Needs immediate investigation. Could be anything from TB or a pulmonary embolism to lung cancer. Never ignore bloody sputum.
Are there other specific colors?
Yes. Rust-colored sputum is pretty specific. It suggests old blood, broken down red blood cells, often seen in certain types of pneumonia like strep pneumo.
Okay.
And maybe the most alarming is pink frothy sputum.
Frothy, like foam.
Exactly. That's almost pathognomonic, a definitive sign of severe pulmonary edema. Fluid is literally leaking from the capillaries into the alveoli. You see this with acute decompensated heart failure. It's an emergency.
Wow. Okay. And you mentioned a GI connection with GERD. Anything else?
Well, sometimes things like frequent hiccups or persistent heartburn can suggest irritation near the diaphragm or the phrenic nerve, which controls it. Less common, but worth keeping in mind.
All right. Completing that patient story involves looking at their environment, genetics, lifestyle.
Absolutely. Family history is big. We need to ask specifically about lung cancer, asthma, emphysema in close relatives. Genetics can play a role, and families often share environmental exposures too.
And lifestyle risks. Smoking is the obvious one.
Obvious, but we need to be thorough. Not just cigarettes. Ask about pipes, cigars, marijuana use, and definitely ask about e-cigarettes or vaping. The long-term data on vaping is still emerging, but we know it's not harmless.
And secondhand smoke exposure.
Critical to quantify that, too. Mm-hmm. Living with a smoker, working in a smoky environment, it all adds up.
Beyond smoking, what environmental or occupational risks are key?
There's a long list, unfortunately. These are things people might have been exposed to years ago that cause problems later. Think asbestos construction, shipbuilding, radon gas, which can seep into basements.
Okay.
Also arsenic, diesel exhaust, silica dust think mining, sandblasting, chromium, fumes from burning fuels like wood or coal indoors, general air pollution, even long-term exposure to talc powder has been linked.
So you really need to ask about past jobs, hobbies, living situations.
You do. And don't forget radiation exposure, maybe past cancer treatment. A personal history of lung cancer obviously increases risk. Even things like poor nutrition or high stress can impact overall lung health and immune function. It's a holistic picture.
Okay, let's move to the hands-on part, the objective assessment. Preparation first. What's key here?
Client comfort and clear communication are paramount. They need to be sitting upright, if possible, relaxed. Explain what you're going to do before you do it.
And the environment?
Room should be warm. Your hands should be warm. Your stethoscope should be warm.
Why warm hands specifically?
Because cold hands touching their back can make them tense up their intercostal muscles. That tension can completely throw off your assessment of chest expansion, making it look decreased or asymmetric when it's not.
Good point. And privacy.
Always. Use proper draping. Only expose the area you're examining at that moment. Respect their dignity.
And what about our approach if we know, say, the patient is a heavy smoker?
Professionalism is key. You need to educate them on the risks associated with smoking, offer resources for quitting, but do it without judgment or shaming.
because that just makes them shut down.
Exactly. They'll be less likely to share other important history if they feel judged. Your goal is to get accurate information to provide the best care.
Okay, so the general inspection. What are we looking for right off the bat?
You start the second you see the patient. Look at their face, their lips, the color of their chest skin, their nails. Normal is even skin tone, pink lips, and nail beds.
And abnormal colors.
Reddish or purplish tones, sometimes called ruddy, can suggest polycythemia. That's excess red blood cells, often the body's response to chronic low oxygen, like in severe COPD or heart failure.
And cyanosis we covered. Check mucous membranes if needed.
Right. Then look at the nail specifically. Check the angle where the nail meets the finger. Normally, it's about 160 degrees.
And if it's not?
If that angle flattens out, becomes 180 degrees or more, and the fingertip looks kind of bulbous or thickened, that's clubbing.
And clubbing means?
It's a sign of long-term chronic hypoxia. Not enough oxygen getting to the tissues over a long period. You see it with COPD, cystic fibrosis, sometimes lung cancer, or other chronic lung diseases.
What about their posture?
Look for the tripod position. That's when someone is leaning forward, resting their hands or elbows on their knees or a table.
Why do they do that?
It helps stabilize their shoulders and chest, allowing them to use their accessory muscles, the neck and shoulder muscles, more effectively to pull air in. It's a classic sign of significant respiratory distress, common in COPD or asthma attacks.
Okay, let's dive into the four main techniques now. Inspection, palpation, percussion, auscultation. Starting with inspection, both front and back.
Right. Anteriorly looking at the front, check the shape of the chest. Note the position of the sternum. Look for any retractions where the skin pulls inward between the ribs or above the clavicles during breathing. That means increased work of breathing.
Check the slope of the ribs too.
Yes, and the overall quality and pattern of respiration. Normal rate is roughly 10 to 20 breaths per minute, should be regular and seem effortless.
What's the costal angle?
That's the angle where the ribs meet the xiphoid process. Normally, it should be less than 90 degrees. If it's wider than 90 degrees, that suggests the ribs are more horizontal, often due to chronic hyperinflation pushing them out.
So abnormal findings up front would be?
A fast rate, say over 24 breaths per minute tachypnea, using those accessory muscles in the neck, sternocleidomastoid, or shoulders, trapezius, just to breathe at rest. That's a clear sign of distress. An abnormally wide costal angle.
Okay. And inspecting from the back?
Posteriorly.
Check the configuration. Are the scapulae, the shoulder blades symmetric? Is the spine straight? And again, assess the overall shape. We look at the ratio of the AP diameter.
Front to back depth.
Versus the transverse diameter side to side width. Normally, the chest is wider than it is deep. The ratio is about 1:2.
And the classic abnormality here is the barrel chest.
Exactly. That's when that AP diameter increases, sometimes becoming equal to the transverse diameter, so the ratio approaches 1:1. The ribs look more horizontal.
And that's caused by chronic air trapping. The lungs are overinflated, they lose their elastic recoil, so air doesn't get pushed out easily. This forces the chest wall outwards over time. It's the hallmark physical sign of emphysema.
Okay, next step, palpation. Feeling the chest wall. What are we assessing?
We're feeling for several things. Any tenderness, which might indicate rib fracture or muscle strain. Any lumps or masses on the surface. Skin temperature and moisture. But two really key findings are crepitus and fremitus.
Crepitus, what does that feel like?
It's a very distinct sensation under your fingertips. Feels like crackling, popping, bubbling. Often described as feeling like Rice Krispie cereal under the skin.
And what does it mean? Is it serious?
Oh, yes. It's a clinical alert. Crepitus means air has leaked out of the lungs or airways and escaped into the subcutaneous tissue, the layer just beneath the skin. It's called subcutaneous emphysema.
Why would that happen?
Could be due to an open chest wound, a complication after getting a tracheostomy, or sometimes if a chest tube isn't functioning properly, or there's a significant air leak from the lung itself, it means there's a breach somewhere. Needs urgent attention.
Okay. And the other key finding was fremitus.
Tactile fremitus, yes. This is the vibration you feel on the chest wall when the patient speaks. You typically have them repeat a phrase like 99 or blue moon.
And how do you feel for it?
Use the bony part of your hand, the ulnar surface, the side of your palm, and press gently against the chest wall. You compare the vibration intensity side to side, moving down the chest, both front and back.
What does the vibration tell you?
It's all about how well sound travels through the underlying tissue. Increased fremitus, stronger vibration suggests the lung tissue underneath is denser, more solid. Like in pneumonia, where the air sacs are filled with fluid or pus, sound travels better through that consolidation.
And decreased fremitus. Weaker vibration.
That means something is blocking the transmission of those vibrations from the airways to your hand. Could be excess air, like in a pneumothorax, or severe emphysema. Could be fluid, like a large pleural effusion, or even just thick chest wall muscle or fat.
Okay. And one more palpation technique, chest expansion.
Right. Assessing how symmetrically the chest extends. You place your hands on the posterior chest wall, maybe around the T9 or T10 level, with your thumbs pointing towards the spine.
Mm-hmm.
Ask the patient to take a slow, deep breath. As they inhale, your thumbs should move apart equally.
And if they don't, if one side moves less.
Asymmetry is the key finding. If one side lags behind or doesn't move much at all, it strongly suggests a problem on that side again, potentially a large pneumothorax, significant atelectasis, maybe even paralysis of the diaphragm on that side. It's often one of the quickest clues to a major unilateral issue.
All right, moving on to percussion. Tapping on the chest, why do we do this?
Percussion helps us figure out the density of the tissue underneath where we're tapping. Is it filled with air, fluid, or is it solid?
How does it work?
You place one finger firmly against the chest wall in an intercostal space and use the middle finger of your other hand to tap sharply on that stationary finger right over the joint. You listen to the sound produced.
And what sounds are we listening for?
The main sound over healthy lung tissue should be resonance. It's a low-pitched, clear, hollow sound because healthy lungs are mostly filled with air.
Okay. What if it's not resonant?
If you hear dullness, which is a softer, shorter, muffled thud, kind of like tapping over your liver. That means the tissue underneath is denser. You'd hear dullness over areas of consolidation, like pneumonia, over a tumor, or over fluid, like in a pleural effusion.
And the opposite, too much air.
That gives you hyperresonance. It's a louder, lower-pitched booming sound than normal resonance. It tells you there's excess air trapped underneath.
Where would you hear that?
Classic finding over hyperinflated lungs in severe emphysema or over a pneumothorax where air has filled the pleural space. You might also hear flatness, which is very dull, over bone like the scapula or heavy muscle.
Is there a specialized percussion technique?
Yes. You can percuss to estimate diaphragmatic excursion. This measures how far the diaphragm moves down during inhalation.
How do you do that?
You percuss down the back until the sound changes from resonant lung to dull, where the diaphragm sits at rest during exhalation. Mark it. Then have the patient take a deep breath and hold it and percuss down again until it turns dull. Mark that. The distance between the marks is the excursion.
And what's normal?
Normally, it's about 3 to 5 centimeters. If it's significantly less or absent on one side, it could indicate diaphragm paralysis due to nerve damage, or maybe severe hyperinflation from COPD is pushing the diaphragm flat and limiting its movement.
Okay, the final pillar, auscultation. Listening with the stethoscope, what are the absolute must-dos here?
Number one, stethoscope diaphragm must be directly on the skin. Never listen over a gown or clothing. The fabric obscures the sounds completely.
Makes sense.
Use firm pressure with the diaphragm. And number two, you must listen through the entire breath cycle, full inspiration and full expiration at every single spot. Don't rush.
Where's the best place to start?
The posterior chest. The back is generally best. Have the client sit upright, leaning forward slightly, with their arms crossed across their lap.
Why the crossed arms?
That pulls the scapulae, the shoulder blades, apart and out of the way, exposing more lung field to listen to.
Okay. And how should they breathe?
Tell them to breathe slowly and deeply through their mouth, a little deeper than normal. Monitor them, though. Deep breathing can sometimes make people feel dizzy, so let them pause if needed.
And the pattern for listening?
Use a systematic side-to-side comparison pattern. Start high up near C7, which is the apex of the lungs,
mm-hmm.
and move downwards, comparing left to right at each level down to the bases around T10. Make sure you avoid listening directly over bone, like the spine or scapulae.
Any other areas to listen?
Yes. Don't forget the lateral chest wall under the axilla, the armpit area. Listen down to about the 7th or 8th rib. Problems like effusions or lower lobe pneumonias often manifest there first.
All right, let's interpret those sounds. First, what are the normal breath sounds we expect to hear and where?
There are three main types. First, bronchial sounds, sometimes called tracheal sounds. These are loud, high-pitched, harsh, almost like air blowing through a pipe.
And where should you hear those?
Only over the trachea and maybe the manubrium, the very top of the sternum. There's a distinct pause between inspiration and expiration with bronchial sounds.
Okay, what's next?
Bronchovesicular sounds. These are kind of intermediate, moderate pitch, moderate loudness. inspiration and expiration duration are roughly equal.
And their location.
You hear these more centrally, posteriorly between the scapulae, especially on the right, anteriorly over the main bronchi near the upper sternum, around the first and second intercostal spaces.
Got it. And the third type?
Vesicular sounds. These should be heard over most of the peripheral lung fields, the majority of the lung area you listen to.
What do they sound like?
They're much softer, lower pitched, almost like a gentle rustling or sighing sound. And importantly, inspiration is much longer than expiration. You might barely hear the expiration.
So here's a key point then. What if you hear, say, loud bronchial sounds out in the periphery where you expect soft vesicular sounds?
That's a really important abnormal finding. It means that the normally air-filled peripheral lung tissue has become dense, consolidated.
Like with pneumonia.
Exactly. The fluid or pus filling the air sacs transmits the loud sounds from the larger central airways much more effectively out to the periphery. So hearing bronchial or bronchovesicular sounds where they don't belong is a strong indicator of consolidation.
Okay, besides location, what about the intensity of the sounds? Can that be abnormal?
Absolutely. The intensity, how loud or soft the sounds are, gives you clues too. You might hear diminished or absent sounds or abnormally increased sounds.
Let's take diminished or absent first. What does that imply?
It means very little or no air is moving in that part of the lung you're listening to.
What could cause that?
Several things. There could be an obstruction blocking the airway leading to that area, like a mucus plug or even a tumor. Or something could be in the pleural space acting as a barrier between the lung and your stethoscope, like a large pleural effusion fluid or a pneumothorax air.
Does emphysema cause diminished sounds too?
Yes. Severe emphysema with hyperinflation can also lead to diminished sounds because the air trapping reduces the velocity of airflow, making the sounds quieter.
And the opposite, abnormally loud sounds.
Increased or louder than expected breath sounds typically occur over areas of consolidation or compression, just like we discussed with hearing bronchial sounds in the periphery.
So the denser tissue conducts sound better.
Right. When the lung tissue becomes more solid, like in pneumonia, it transmits the sound from the airways more efficiently, making the breath sounds seem louder or harsher than they should in that location.
All right. Now for the sounds everyone asks about, the added sounds, the adventitious sounds. Let's break these down. Wheezes first.
Okay. Wheezes are continuous musical sounds. They happen because air is being forced through airways that are narrowed or constricted. We usually divide them into high-pitched and low-pitched.
High-pitched first.
The high-pitched wheeze, often called sibilant wheeze, this is that classic squeaking musical sound, can happen during inspiration, expiration, or both.
What causes that specific sound?
It's air whistling through narrowed, smaller airways, bronchioles, due to things like swelling, inflammation, smooth muscle spasm, or secretions. This is the hallmark sound of asthma, but you can hear it in chronic bronchitis or emphysema, too.
Okay. And the low-pitched wheeze?
Low-pitched wheeze, or sonorous wheeze, sometimes called raunchy. This sounds more like snoring, moaning, or groaning. It's usually louder during expiration.
What's the mechanism here?
This suggests obstruction or narrowing in the larger airways, the bronchi, often due to thick secretions. The key differentiator here is that low-pitched wheezes, or raunchy, often clear temporarily after the patient coughs.
Because coughing moves the secretions.
Exactly. If they clear with a cough, it points towards secretions being the main issue, like an acute bronchitis. If they persist despite coughing, it might suggest a more fixed obstruction.
Okay, wheeze is covered. Next up, crackles, also called rail.
Right. Crackles are discontinuous sounds, short, popping, or bubbling noises. Unlike wheezes, they're not musical. We divide them into fine and coarse.
Tell us about fine crackles.
Fine crackles are soft, high-pitched, and very brief. Like the sound of rolling strands of hair between your fingers right next to your ear, or maybe like fire crackling. They are primarily heard during inspiration.
And crucially?
Crucially, fine crackles are not cleared by coughing.
Why not? What causes them?
The mechanism is thought to be inhaled air suddenly popping open small airways, terminal bronchioles, or alveoli that were previously collapsed or deflated and possibly coated with sticky fluid or exudate.
Does it matter when in inspiration you hear them?
Yes, the timing is clinically important. Fine crackles heard late in inspiration are often associated with restrictive diseases like pneumonia or congestive heart failure, suggesting fluid in the peripheral alveoli.
And early inspiration.
Fine crackles heard early in inspiration are more typical of obstructive diseases, like chronic bronchitis, asthma, or emphysema, possibly related to the opening of larger proximal airways.
Okay. Now, coarse crackles. How are they different?
Coarse crackles are louder, lower pitched, and last longer than fine crackles. They sound more like bubbling or gurgling, sometimes described like Velcro being ripped apart, can be heard on inspiration, and sometimes expiration.
What's the mechanism for coarse crackles?
These suggest air colliding with secretions in the larger airways, the trachea and bronchi. Think thipper mucus, pus, or fluid.
So conditions like?
You hear them commonly in pulmonary edema, severe pneumonia, bronchitis, or conditions like pulmonary fibrosis, where there's significant airway disruption. Unlike fine crackles, sometimes coarse crackles might change or diminish slightly with coughing if secretions are moved.
Is there a type of crackle that isn't necessarily pathologic?
Yes. Atelectatic crackles. These are fine crackles, but they're not due to disease. You often hear them at the lung bases, especially in aging adults, people who are bedridden, or just after someone wakes up.
Why do they happen?
It's just because some alveoli haven't been fully inflated for a while, and they pop open with the first few deep breaths.
So how do you know they're just atelectatic?
The key is that they always clear after the patient takes a few deep breaths or coughs. They are transient. You need to distinguish these from pathologic fine crackles.
Okay, important distinction. Now, are there any sounds that signal an immediate emergency?
Absolutely. Top of the list is stridor.
What does stridor sound like?
It's a very loud, high-pitched, inspiratory crowing or gasping sound. It's harsh. You can often hear it without a stethoscope.
And it mean?
It signals a severe obstruction high up in the airway in the larynx or trachea. This is a life-threatening emergency. It could be severe laryngospasm, epiglottitis, or a foreign object blocking the airway. It needs immediate intervention.
Okay, stridor is an emergency. What about a pleural friction rub?
A pleural friction rub is also significant. It's a coarse, low-pitched, grating or rubbing sound, kind of like leather rubbing together or walking on fresh snow. It's heard on both inspiration and expiration.
What causes it?
It happens when the two layers of the pleura become inflamed and lose their lubricating fluid. So instead of gliding smoothly, they rub directly against each other during breathing. It's the characteristic sound of pleuritis.
You mentioned voice sounds earlier as an advanced technique.
Yes, these are used to confirm suspected consolidation when your other findings are suggestive. They rely on the fact that sound travels differently through consolidated lung tissue compared to normal air-filled lung. Three main ones: bronchophony, egophony, whispered pectoralically.
Let's focus on egophony. How does that work?
For egophony, you have the patient say the letter E repeatedly while you listen with your stethoscope over the suspected area.
And what do you hear?
Normally, you should hear a muffled E sound, but if the underlying lung tissue is consolidated, the sound gets distorted, and you'll hear a nasal sounding I instead. That E to A change is a very specific sign of consolidation.
And whispered pectoralically.
You ask the patient to whisper a phrase like 1, 2, 3. Normally, over peripheral lung fields, a whisper should be faint and indistinct. But if there's consolidation, the whispered words sound surprisingly clear and loud through the stethoscope. Again, confirms increased sound transmission through dense tissue.
Okay, rounding things out, let's look at visual cues again, especially abnormal breathing patterns and chest shapes, tying them to chronic conditions.
Right. The pattern of breathing tells you a lot. We know normal is 12-20 breaths min. Tachypnea is faster, 24 VMN, but usually shallow, often seen with fever, anxiety, restrictive lung disease.
And bradypnea.
That's slow breathing, 10 min, but regular rhythm. Can be caused by drug overdoses like opioids, increased intracranial pressure, or sometimes just excellent athletic conditioning.
What about depth and effort variations?
Hyperventilation involves both increased rate and increased depth. Blowing off too much CO2 can be caused by anxiety, metabolic acidosis, or brain injury.
Versus hypoventilation.
That's decreased rate, decreased depth, often irregular, leads to CO2 retention, seen with overdose, anesthesia, or severe neuromuscular disease affecting breathing muscles.
And there's some really specific named patterns, right? Kussmaul.
Yes. Kussmaul respiration is very distinct. Rapid, deep, and labored breathing. Almost looks like air hunger. It's the body's attempt to compensate for severe metabolic acidosis by blowing off CO2. Classic finding in diabetic ketoacidosis. DKA.
What about chain Stokes?
Chain Stokes is a cyclic pattern. You see periods of progressively deeper, faster breathing, followed by periods of shallower breathing, eventually leading to a period of apnea, complete cessation of breathing. Then the cycle repeats.
What causes that pattern?
It's often related to problems in the brain's respiratory control center, commonly seen in severe heart failure, stroke, renal failure, or sometimes near the end of life.
How is that different from biot respiration?
Biot respiration is also cyclic with periods of apnea, but it's highly irregular. The breaths are variable in depth and rate, followed by unpredictable apneic pauses. It usually indicates severe brain damage, particularly to the pons.
Okay. And one more pattern. Ataxic?
Ataxic respiration is completely irregular. Both depth and rate vary randomly. It's disorganized breathing, also indicating severe brainstem dysfunction, considered even more ominous than BIOS.
And we need to recognize air trapping visually, too.
Right. That's less about rate and rhythm, more about the effort of exhaling. Patients with obstructive diseases like COPD or severe asthma struggle to get air out. Expiration becomes prolonged, often active and effortful, leading to that hyperinflation and barrel chest over time.
Speaking of chest shape, let's revisit those abnormalities. We covered the barrel chest with COPD.
Right, that increased AP diameter, horizontal ribs, clear sign of chronic air trapping and lost elasticity.
What about other structural deformities? Pectus excavatum.
Pectus excavatum, or funnel chest, is where the sternum and adjacent ribs are sunken inward, creating a depression.
And pectus carinatum.
That's the opposite pigeon chest. The sternum protrudes outwards. Both are often congenital. Usually they're just cosmetic, but very severe cases can potentially restrict heart or lung function.
And spinal deformities.
Big impact. Scoliosis, that lateral S-shaped curve of the spine, and kyphosis, the exaggerated outward hunchback curve we mentioned earlier, both can significantly distort the thoracic cage.
How does that affect breathing?
They reduce the overall volume of the chest cavity, restrict lung expansion, make the work of breathing harder, and can lead to ventilation perfusion mismatch and chronic respiratory issues over time.
And all these structural issues plus the disease processes lead to those abnormal findings we detect, right? Consolidation, atelectasis.
Exactly. They can predispose patients to or be caused by these underlying pathologies. Consolidation, dense, fluid-filled lung, obstructive atelectasis, collapse due to a blockage, pneumothorax, air in the pleural space collapsing the lung, and pleural effusion, fluid accumulating in that space. Our assessment techniques help us pinpoint which of these might be happening.
Let's tie this together with two major chronic conditions. First, COPD.
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It's a huge public health issue, fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. It includes conditions like emphysema and chronic bronchitis. The key feature is progressive, largely irreversible airflow limitation.
Pathophysiology, what's happening inside?
It's primarily an abnormal inflammatory response in the lungs, usually triggered by long-term exposure to irritants, mostly cigarette smoke.
And the difference between emphysema and chronic bronchitis.
In emphysema, the inflammation destroys the walls of the alveoli, the tiny air sacs. They lose elasticity, merge together into larger, ineffective sacs, trapping air. That's what leads to hyperinflation and the barrel chest. In chronic bronchitis, the inflammation is mainly in the larger airways, the bronchi. It causes thickening of the bronchial walls and excessive mucus production, leading to that chronic cough and sputum production. Most people with COPD have features of both.
We know smoking is the biggest risk factor.
Right.
What else?
Definitely occupational exposures, dusts, chemicals, fumes. Air pollution plays a role. Rarely there's a genetic component called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Age is also a factor, usually diagnosed after 40.
What are the key signs and symptoms we look for?
Chronic cough, often productive, especially in the morning. Progressive dyspnea worsens over time, initially with exertion. Wheezing, especially end expiratory. The tripod position during distress, the barrel chest shape, sometimes weight loss because breathing takes so much energy.
Management focuses on prevention and symptom control.
Yes. Avoiding irritants is number one, stop smoking. Vaccinations against flu and pneumonia are critical. Medications like bronchodilators help open airways. Pulmonary rehab is very important. And teaching COPRA techniques.
Like pursed lip breathing.
Absolutely essential. Teach them to inhale normally through the nose, then exhale slowly and steadily through tightly pursed lips, like they're blowing out a candle, for twice as long as they inhaled.
What does that do?
It creates back pressure inside the airways during exhalation, preventing them from collapsing prematurely. This helps empty trapped air more effectively, reduces dyspnea, and gives them more control over their breathing. Using the tripod position during shortness of breath also helps maximize accessory muscle use.
And the other major condition, lung cancer.
Still a devastating diagnosis. Second leading cause of cancer death overall in the U.S., broadly divided into small cell and non-small cell types, which guides treatment.
Risk factors overlap a lot with COPD.
Boy, heavily. Smoking tobacco is paramount, cigarettes, pipes, cigars. Secondhand smoke exposure is a major risk, too. Marijuana smoke also contains carcinogens. And increasingly, we're concerned about the long-term risks of vaping, though data is still evolving.
And the environmental occupational risks.
Same list we discussed. Asbestos, radon gas in homes, arsenic, diesel exhaust, silica, chromium, significant air pollution. Also, a personal history of radiation therapy to the chest or a family history of lung cancer increases risk. Even diet might play a small role.
What signs might point towards lung cancer during assessment?
Often symptoms are vague initially or mimic other conditions, but key warning signs include a new cough that doesn't go away or changes, coughing up blood, hemoptysis, persistent chest pain, recurrent pneumonia or bronchitis that keeps occurring in the same lung area, unexplained weight loss, fatigue, and sometimes new onset wheezing or hoarseness. Clubbing of the fingers can also be a late sign.
Prevention and screening are key here.
Absolutely. Prevention means avoiding tobacco smoke and known carcinogens. Testing homes for radon is important. Using protective equipment if exposed at work. For screening, annual low-dose CT scans are recommended for high-risk individuals, typically current or former heavy smokers within a certain age range.
Because early detection makes a huge difference.
Massive difference. Finding lung cancer at an earlier stage significantly improves treatment options and prognosis. Educating patients about risks and the importance of screening and reporting persistent symptoms is a critical nursing role.
So we've really covered a lot of ground here. From the basic anatomy, like that vulnerable right main bronchus and aspiration risk, to how percussion sounds change with density, how voice sounds get amplified through consolidation.
Right. We connected the subjective complaints, like that pink frothy sputum, meaning immediate concern for pulmonary edema, to the objective findings, like diminished sound suggesting the hyperinflation of emphysema. It's about putting all those pieces together.
It really is that synthesis, isn't it? Moving beyond just listing findings to understanding the why behind them.
Oh.
Hopefully, this serves as that comprehensive guide we aimed for.
Exactly. Understanding the mechanisms turns assessment from a task into a powerful diagnostic tool.
Okay, to wrap up, let's leave our listeners with a final provocative thought to chew on.
All right. We talked about how diminished breath sounds can indicate hyperinflation and severe emphysema. Now, imagine that patient known severe COPD, likely emphysema, suddenly develops acute unilateral absence of breath sounds on one side, along with sharp pain and rapidly worsening respiratory distress.
Okay, unilateral absence of sound in an emphysema patient.
What potentially catastrophic, life-threatening complication should immediately leap to the very top of your list of possible diagnoses? And why is it such an emergency, thinking back to those pleural layers and pressure dynamics we discussed early on?
Something acute, unilateral, involving air pressure and those pleural layers. Definitely something to think about. Needs fast action.